Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is a renowned academic, Professor Ruth Weiss, author of the seminal book, Jews and Power, just reissued in paperback form. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mevina on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been coordinating a study group on Musar, a fascinating area of Jewish learning, for about the past 3 months, and it's been an extraordinary experience. The Hebrew word Musar is often translated as ethics, but it is not exactly that. It's rather the effort to enhance the personality traits or characteristics, the midot we wish to emphasize, and to diminish the ones we wish to limit. The process itself is quite fascinating. As a group, we study texts, mostly Jewish, but also not, that focus on the midah, the characteristic we are exploring. Then we discuss it, work both in close partnership with one or two other people, and then with the whole group, and explore how that trait impacts our life, and how we might improve ourselves in that area. This Musar work brings up a great deal of personal experience, forces us to be open, honest, and trusting, and helps work on being better people in areas like patience, equanimity, courage, humility, gratitude, order, compassion, and honor. It has been a quiet revelation teaching this class and being part of this group, as it encourages what is best in each of us and quells some of the characteristics that are not so laudable. I personally find myself becoming a little more patient, a little less obsessed with self, a little kinder and more understanding. While I find the book that's used for the class a little light on content, everybody else seems to love it, so that's probably another area I need to work on, intellectual humility. The positive impact of this class has been wonderful, but there's also been a downside. It comes from watching the way that public discourse in America has become degraded and diminished in recent years. This is quite the opposite of the teachings of the Musar scholars, who emphasize personal character over self-interest and teach appropriate levels of restraint and balance as models for good human behavior. When I see public proclamations on platforms like Twitter or Facebook and other social media platforms, and in the non-social media, I find myself wondering whether the people making those statements have any ability at all to enter into personal self-reflection, as Musar requires. Attacking one's perceived enemies with slanderous statements, impugning their motivations and character, using hurtful language that's not based in fact, those are not ways to create a better world. Instead, that's descending to the lowest forms of human conduct and expression, and it's damaging and unsuitable for responsible adults, let alone those in important leadership roles. I'm not sure exactly when it became acceptable to assault the patriotism of war heroes, or the integrity of whistleblowers, or the faith of religious men and women, or the honesty of people whose accurate information is well documented. I don't know when it became defensible to simply demean everybody who doesn't agree with you through unwarranted personal attack. But it has now become standard practice on virtually every important statement and meaningful issue that's going on. Perhaps it comes down to something I've spoken of often lately, and which seems continually to be under assault. Another crucial midah, another central personal attribute. Honesty. You know, truth. Truth is not always relative to perception. Everybody may have a unique perspective, but certain facts are simply that, facts. They don't improve by being misstated or twisted into unrecognizable shapes. It is our responsibility as adults to answer the heated rhetoric with simple facts, not to allow ourselves to get sucked into the maelstrom of public invective that haunts our lives today. And it is also our responsibility to choose leaders who reflect the values that we ourselves seek to model in our own lives. These midot, these valuable qualities we cultivate, should also be qualities we wish to see cultivated in our society and in the world at large. To play us in this morning, here's a classic cantorial setting of Elu Dvarim She'en Lahem Shiur. These are the things that have no measure, the greatest deeds we can do for one another, honoring father and mother, kindness to strangers, studying and praying with energy and sincerity, hospitality to guests, visiting the sick, assisting the wedding couple, burying the dead, consoling the bereaved, and making peace between people. Elu Devarim. Excellent midot for all of us. Cantor Yoel Ausch singing Elu Dvarim, the acts we need to do for one another, for our world, for God, and in a way, for ourselves, too. Our guest this morning, Professor Ruth Wise, is one of the most distinguished Jewish scholars in America. Her important book, Choose and Power, has just been released in paperback. We'll explore the Jewish relationship to government, its role in anti-Semitism, a little bit about Israel, and just what all that means today when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. a new progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the Catalina Foothills. Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's move to larger quarters, our new synagogue location, 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are available to everybody. Join us this Friday night at 6:30 p.m., 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them with delicious food, both after Friday night and after Saturday morning. Our new synagogues at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, not in the mall, but in our own building. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and of course, all of our services Friday night and Saturday, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimcha Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing and newest Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Ruth Weiss is one of the most distinguished Jewish academics in America, Professor Emeritus of Yiddish Literature and Comparative Literature at Harvard, Senior Fellow at the Tikva Fund, the author of 5 books and many articles. Her seminal book, Jews and Power, has just been reissued in paperback form for the first time. And while it certainly seemed a very appropriate topic back in 2007 when it was first published, it certainly seems maybe even more important now. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me.
What prompted the reissue and it's the first time ever in paperback. Not too many great Jewish books come out in paperback, by the way, I have to say. Mazel tov.
Thank you so much. Yes, I was very glad to see it in paperback because I think it circulates much more easily in this form.
What prompted this bringing out Jews in Power again right now?
Well, I think that the book is essentially about how Jews function in history and why anti-Semitism works, how and why it works. And since anti-Semitism has unfortunately increased both geographically and in its ferocity, I think that people realize that far from disappearing, this subject has become really much more urgent. I think that the publishers realized that, and so I'm very glad that they agreed to republish the book.
I want to reflect on the timing a little bit. In 2007, when this came out, you know, the relationship of Jews to power was subservient for so long, and yet when this came out, it seemed clear that that was no longer the realistic appraisal of the Jewish role. With this surge in anti-Semitism, does it seem more important to reflect on that now?
Well, you know, the book could have been called Jews and Politics because its real subject is how the Jews function in political life, in political affairs. And one of the main things that I wanted to argue in this book was that although many people believed that the Jews ceased to function politically in history, that when they lost their sovereignty in the land of Israel and began to live among other nations, they ceased to be a political people. Now, this used to be a very, very popular, I would say almost universally held idea. The great historians believed that. Some thought that this was a terrible tragedy. Some thought that it was all could be interpreted to the good, but there was a widespread idea that Jews had ceased to function politically. Now, my argument is that this is entirely wrong. that Jews have were always a part of political history, and that they became even more so, if anything, once they lost their sovereignty in the land of Israel and had to find a way of functioning politically among other nations. So the book is divided in a way into these two parts: how the Jews functioned politically, how they managed to function politically through all those years without a homeland of their own, and how that led to the possibility of anti-Jewish politics in a variety of forms.
When we come back on to Jewish, we'll explore what it means to have anti-Jewish politics, and also how Jews have kind of come into their own, which is also explored in a really fascinating way in Jews in Power. We'll be back with Professor Ruth Weiss in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we've been talking about anti-Semitism over the last few weeks and its rise, violent anti-Semitism in America in particular, and some of the responses and complexities of the issue, and lessons we can learn from other parts of the world that can help us here. Maybe there's some lessons we can learn from our own tradition, and maybe the most important stereotype that we've had to fight for centuries now is the idea that Jews are all about money and they're running the international banking system, and that lately has morphed into we're controlling all immigration. And I mean, it's absurd on the face of it and factually absurd, and yet it persists.
Yeah, this is unfortunately one of those anti-Semitic tropes that just refuses to die. I mean, even very recently, I heard like, well, the Rothschilds are controlling the impeachment process.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's like...
The Rothschilds haven't been all that relevant for, I don't know, 75 years?
Exactly.
Years?
But it's, you know, the same part of the population that used to blame the Rockefellers for everything. And that believed the Rockefellers were Jews as well.
Would have been news to the Rockefellers, of course.
I mean, it's all totally ignorant. But I think there is a link in the minds of many people between Jews and money and capitalism and controlling exchange rates and the international banking system, which is utterly irrational for many years. In fact, in the banking industry in the U.S., Jews were kept out of any senior positions. It was one of the last bastions of the WASPs. But there is, let's look within our own tradition on this for a second, because there's this very important rabbinic teaching that's kind of a paradox, which says, Im ein kemach ein Torah, ella im ein Torah ein kemach, which means literally, if there's no flour, if there's no food on the table,
there's no bread,
right, then there's no Torah, there's no learning, there's no study of Torah, there's no Jewish values, whatever. But if there's no Torah, there's no food on the table. Now, this can go many ways, but one of the important ways, I think, is very few people understand that there's a Talmudic teaching that even a meal which is perfectly kosher ritually in terms of the dishes, the food, everything prepared under rabbinic supervision, distinctions between milk and meat, the meat was slaughtered in a coat, whatever, all that stuff, the meal is not theologically kosher unless you exchange words of Torah
right
at the meal. And you stand up with more knowledge than you sat down with. Otherwise, you've just eaten, but it's not really a theologically kosher meal. So that's a remarkable concept. And it implies that, yes, we need money to run Jewish schools and provide a Jewish education. But at the same time, if we have money without Jewish values and Jewish education, it's worthless.
It comes back to that central aspect of Judaism, which is Torah, which is learning, education for moral and ethical purpose. And even if it's just learning for its own sake, Torah Lishma, it builds character and knowledge and intellectual ability to understand what God wants for us in the world. And the idea that Judaism is all about money is just so antithetical to that, because even there's even Torah of money, you know, like how do you make sure that things are done ethically and appropriately? Doesn't mean there aren't mistakes made and that there aren't evil people in any group, but it's really important to respond to that stereotype and to understand for yourself how important Judaism understands the process of learning and committing yourself to a sacred course.
I couldn't agree more.
Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to next week.
It's time for our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective segment. Just in time for primary season, President Trump unveiled his plan for peace between Israelis and Palestinians last month. To date, it's notable it has received positive reviews only from the Trump administration itself and from Bibi Netanyahu's Israeli Likud administration. In surveys of popular opinion around the world, the only country in which it is receiving even 50% approval ratings is Israel. Last week, the Arab League's 22 member nations unanimously rejected the U.S.-Israeli quote-unquote deal of the century. They said they considered that it does not meet the minimum rights and aspirations of Palestinian people. In addition, while Netanyahu initially stated Israel would move to annex areas of the West Bank allocated to it under the plan, the Trump administration indicated it would not approve of such annexation prior to the Israeli elections scheduled for March. On the American election front, Orthodox organizations were expected to heartily approve of the plan, while non-Orthodox Jewish groups, the vast majority of Jewish voters in America, were highly critical of it as being one-sided and unrealistic. That was our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A Jewish guy is sitting at a bar, just staring at the drink he's holding, not drinking it. He stays like that for like an hour. A huge, troublemaking anti-Semite sees the Jew sitting there, walks up next to him, grabs the drink from his hand, and drinks it all down at once. The poor man is startled, looks up, and starts crying. The anti-Semite says, "Oh, come on, Jew, I was just kidding. Look, I'll buy you another drink. I just can't stand to see a grown man cry. Not even a Jew." "No, it's not that," the Jewish guy replies, wiping tears from his eyes. "This day is the worst day of my life. First I oversleep, I'm late for work, my boss fires me. I leave the building to go to my car and it was stolen. The police say they can do nothing. I call a cab to get home and when I get out, I remember I left my wallet, but the cab driver drives away. I go inside the house, I find out the water main busted and flooded the house, ruining the floors. My wife tells me she can't stand what a failure I am, and she's leaving me. I walk out. I come to this bar. And just when I'm ready to put an end to my miserable life, you show up and drink my cup of poison." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And don't drink anybody else's drink, not even on Purim. We welcome our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So Israel's experiencing some demographic changes with immigration. We're used to thinking about Israel, which absolutely is a nation of all immigrants, right? To choose from 150, 160 countries, many of which don't even exist anymore. But the people that have come in recent years who are doing a lot of the work that fresh immigrants used to do are now coming from Africa, they're coming from East Asia. Tell us about your own experiences with some of those people in your own lives.
Okay, so for myself, for example, not a lot of people from those countries live in my city.
Yeah, Ramat Gan is not, you know, a heavy Eritrean city,
or Sudanese. But you absolutely can see them, for example, Sudanese or Eritreans work for restaurants as cleaners.
Busboys,
street cleaners. A lot of Indonesians, Filipinos, also immigrants from Romania, Moldova, those parts of Europe. assistant for the elderlies,
right, and healthcare assistance, right, and, right, and personal aides, right, right,
and some of them are illegal, but that's my part of exposure to them.
Right, so a real experience. Danielle, you know, you live in a kind of a rural, yeah, idyllic
in my
area.
Own bubble, yes.
In your own bubble, so, as you talked about in the past. And yet, there's immigrants there too.
Yes. So, but the way that I'm used to seeing them is, so it's usually more the Filipinians, if it's either helping the elderly in my moshav, in my settlement, just like assisting them and whatever. I also live in a very farmers area, agriculture, and those farmers, they get a lot of help from Filipinians, just like helping
so
them in the field.
So if it's a harvest time, getting extra workers in to harvest crops?
Like, I don't think it's just like the normal workers. That's just
workers,
the people
not
who
necessarily
work.
Trained agriculture, yeah, workers, but
exactly, just people,
to come
looking
and do
for
stuff.
Work, yeah, right, and finding it. Over there.
You know, they used to talk, it used to be Arabs that did a lot of this work, right,
yeah,
to be frank. Sometimes they were migrant workers or workers that would come over from the West Bank, and it used to be from Gaza, probably, yeah, not happening anymore.
No, it's just Filipinians and Russians.
Yeah. Filipinos, Russians,
yes,
as you said, Moldovans. Are there still professions that are sort of considered Arab professions?
I think a lot of construction work and buildings work, still a lot of Arabs work there.
Manicures, it's the woman.
Yeah, but
hair salons,
nails, stuff like that.
You could always, mm-hmm, you could always identify if it's the Arabs doing, if it's more outgoing and glittery and extra and colorful.
The Arabs have more color.
Yes, they like,
right,
yes.
Yes, exactly. But I think a lot of Chinese people, Russian, as we said, are getting more and more involved in those kind of works.
It'll be very interesting to see how Israel, because coping with immigrant populations, which Israel is an expert at if they're Jews, and trying to integrate them over the course of time, more or less expert, going to be a little different in these populations. And I think there are already challenges. It'll be very interesting to see how that evolves over the coming years, because Israel is a first world country now. You know,
right,
it's a different world.
Exactly.
Thanks so much, guys. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Mishpatim includes as many laws as any part of the whole Torah. After the last few weeks of dramatic, really spectacular Torah portions, featuring some of the greatest highlights in the whole of Jewish tradition, indeed of all religious history, Mishpatim comes as a major letdown. Last week, amid the smoke and thunder of Mount Sinai, we received the Ten Commandments. The week before, God parted the sea for us. We miraculously crossed on dry land. In the weeks before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians, and Pharaoh and Moses had their duel of wills in the desert. But Mishpatim is nothing more than a collection of laws about how to interact with other human beings. Civil legislation. How exciting. How to handle somebody else's property fairly. How to assess punitive damages for a man who injures another person or destroys somebody's property. How to act when someone puts his or her property in trust. The laws of manslaughter, theft, damages, boring laws, many of them tediously detailed. And you know, no one really likes reading law books. If the Torah is truly our fundamental moral text, this is an array of detailed legislation about human interaction that seems so trivial as not even to belong in the Torah. So why is Mishpatim here? Well, human beings have no love of law, or usually of lawyers, but without laws and without enforcement, we fallible creatures wouldn't function well at all. In fact, the Mishnah tells us we would tear each other apart. Where anarchy reigns, justice doesn't. And that's where Mishpatim comes in. For we need law, and we need limits, although we might not like either one very much. Judaism understands that if we are to be truly good or truly free, we must observe the laws and rules of human decency embodied in the code of legislation that makes up Mishpatim. Because before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, as the Torah tells us, we must first respect that human being's property and person. Before we can make this world holy, we must treat each other with civility. It is a great fundamental lesson we seem to need to relearn in every generation. A final note, At the end of this week's Parsha, after all of the rules and laws, the torts and talionises, God reveals a glimpse of the divine essence to Moses. Why here? Because Mishpatim teaches that we can only experience real holiness when we begin by respecting our fellow men and women, when we come to understand that we are all in this together, and that the way to God is actually through the ways we learn to work together and trust one another. And we must do this in simple, practical, daily ways by following decent rules for human interaction. Freedom and holiness depend on the little laws established in Mishpatim, on the civility that rules require. May we all remember that this week and every week. When we return, our guest, the distinguished academic Ruth Wise, will explore why the question of Jews and power is so important today, and just where anti-Semitism comes from. Find out when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Alexander Vindman's synagogue in Springfield, Virginia, is accepting letters of support on his behalf. Vindman, the Jewish staffer who was among the first to raise flags about President Donald Trump's pressure on Ukraine to investigate a political rival, the Bidens, was removed from his position as an expert on U.S. policy in Ukraine at the National Security Council last week and marched out of the White House. The Vindman family is a valued member of Congregation Adat Reim's community of friends. We are proud to support Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman during this challenging time, said Rebecca Geller, co-president of Congregation Adat Reim. In addition, for those seeking ways to show support, the Vindman family has requested donations be made to the synagogue via adatreim.org in Alexander Vindman's honor. Trump also recalled Gordon Sondland, U.S. ambassador to the European Union. Both Vindman and Sondland testified against Trump in the U.S. House of Representatives, providing damaging testimony that led to Trump's impeachment. Their removal comes just days after Trump was acquitted by the Republican-led U.S. Senate in an impeachment trial. Also last week, Vindman's twin brother, Lieutenant Colonel Yevgeny Vindman, was asked to leave his job as a White House lawyer. Both Vindmans, Jews who immigrated with their father from Ukraine in 1979, were reassigned to the Army. Vindman said during his testimony that his father feared his speaking out would bring retaliation, which, of course, it has, as President Donald Trump purged anyone who told the truth about his efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. In other news, a German court ruled last week that a 700-year-old anti-Semitic sculpture could stay on the exterior of a church in the city of Wittenberg, dismissing a claim by a member of the local Jewish community that it was defamatory and should be removed. The court case comes amid a national debate in Germany about rising anti-Jewish hate after an anti-Semitic gunman killed two people near a synagogue and tried to break into it in the eastern city of Halle last year on Yom Kippur. The Judensau, or Jew pig, on a wall of Wittenberg St. Mary's Church is a reminder of widespread anti-Semitism in the Middle Ages. It depicts a rabbi lifting the tail of a sow and peeping at its bottom while Jewish children suckle on the sow. The higher regional court in Naumburg ruled that displaying the Judensau, which is 12 feet above the ground, does not constitute an offense. The sculpture in its current context has neither an insulting character nor does it violate the plaintiff's personal rights, the judgment said. Sigmund Königsberg of Berlin's Jewish community said, "We don't want this Judensau to disappear. It should be on public display, but not on the side of a church. It belongs in a museum alongside clear historical context about anti-Semitism in the Middle Ages." St. Mary's Church said in a statement that it acknowledged with sadness that there were those who would feel hurt and offended by the sculpture, but it added that back in 1988, in consultation with the Jewish community, it created a site of remembrance incorporating the Judensau, a plaque on the ground beneath it remembering the 6 million Jews murdered in the Holocaust, and an information board. The court said the information board clearly states the parish distanced itself from the persecution of Jews, the anti-Judaic writings of Martin Luther, and the mocking aim of the defamatory sculpture. This is the second time in 2 years a court has ruled against the removal of Wittenberg's Judensau, one of about 24 such sculptures from the Middle Ages still featured on churches in Germany and elsewhere in Europe. The German government is trying to tame an alarming rise in anti-Semitism with stricter laws against hate speech online, tougher gun ownership rules, and increased campaigns to raise awareness. Last week, Duke University resolved a discrimination complaint filed by the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights over a Middle East conference on Gaza it co-sponsored with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The Zionist Organization of America filed the complaint in April 2019 over the conference held at the University of North Carolina entitled Conflict Over Gaza, People, Politics, and Possibilities. The conference featured a performance by the Palestinian rapper Tamer Nafar that was condemned as anti-Semitic. Days after the conference, swastikas and anti-Semitic flyers were discovered on campus. North Carolina agreed to a resolution agreement with the Department of Education back in November. Under this agreement, Duke was required to issue a statement to all university students, faculty, and staff against discrimination with an emphasis on anti-Semitism. Kimberly Hewitt, Vice President for Institutional Equity and a Chief Diversity Officer, emailed the statement to the community, the Duke Chronicle student newspaper reported. Simply put, the university does not tolerate anti-Semitism. I encourage any member of the community to report when such conduct occurs. The complaint was originally filed under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act that prohibits national origin and other forms of discrimination at federally funded programs and protects Jewish students from anti-Semitic harassment.
האושר פה ומיד ליד, ורק אני צוחקת ובוכה. אני לא יודעת למה, לא יודעת איך, חיים עם כל זה ככה וכלום לי לא הולך. הלב שלי בבטן מתהפך ומסתבך, אני כאן לבד. עומדת במרפסת, פותחת התריסים, שייכנס האור, שיעופו פרפרים. אני יודעת, זה רק עניין של זמן, יש בי
Israel is different from other countries, including America, particularly in the attitude of its young people towards national military service. Last week, Noah Carell, an 18-year-old Israeli female pop star who twice won MTV Europe Music's Award for Best Israeli Act, joined the Israeli military, the IDF. Carell became a YouTube sensation back in 2015 and has starred in TV and films in Israel in addition to her very successful music career. She will serve in the Orchestra Corps, which performs in parades, official military and state ceremonies, graduation courses, and entertains the troops. Carell will have her own band rather than join an already established army band. She said about entering the IDF, "It's crazy and a huge privilege." The Israeli Defense Forces had to establish special guidelines to deal with the star, forbidding fellow soldiers from taking selfies with her or photographing her on the military base. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back our guest this morning, Professor Ruth Weiss, the author of Jews and Power, which has just been re-released with a new introduction by Professor Weiss in paperback. It's an extraordinary exploration of the Jewish role in history. And as we discussed earlier, the notion that Jews were excluded from politics wasn't really correct. In going back through the book, because I'm sure you reread it before it was republished, what surprised you?
I guess that what surprises me is that it becomes, you know, more vital that people begin to understand this. You know, there's so much attention being paid to anti-Semitism nowadays, and there are many more institutions that now undertake to chart it. So we have statistics on where it is spreading. We have a lot of descriptions about what it looks like, who's doing what, where it is appearing, what forms it is taking. But I find that what I was arguing in this book, that Jewish politics has to be taken seriously in political study, not just by the Jews, but in political science, in the study of government, in the study of political history, that this has not happened to my mind. And so what remains surprising is that there is so little universal recognition of the degree to which this anomaly of Jewish historical and political existence, to what extent this has really affected other nations, why they have made such use of the Jews as a political foil, as a political target.
Why do you think they have?
Well, I think they have because it works.
Right.
I look at the functions of anti-Semitism. What role does it play in the life of those nations, of those societies or groups that use it? And when you look at it that way, you see how useful it is. For example, when the Arab League organized in 1945, these were nations, these were countries that had very little in common. In some cases, they were very much at odds with one another. But they wanted an Arab League, a pan-Arab League, and the one thing that united them was common antagonism and common aggression against Israel. They were all against the idea of coexistence with the Jewish people and with a Jewish state. And that became the main organizing principle, the glue of Arab solidarity. Now, that is such an important political function that it's very hard for Arab leaders to let it go. And when you look at it that way, you see the much of what is said about the so-called Arab-Israel conflict or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I mean, these are terms which are really not applicable because this is a unilateral aggression against the Jews, which serves the purposes of those who are doing the aggressing.
You can make a case that the greatest success, I don't know the right way to put it, but the most enduring legacy of Hitler was in the form of anti-Semitism he exported into the Arab world. Was it there already? Was he? Was Goebbels propaganda just, you know, you can read newspapers today that read quite a lot like Der Stürmer in the Arab world.
Well, this is true, but that's less than half the issue because, in fact, the Arab propaganda only began to work in the West after the Arabs changed from right-wing anti-Semitism that, as you say, was introduced through Hitlerism, to left-wing anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, which had developed in the Soviet Union. And in fact, when the Arabs really began to succeed in spreading anti-Zionism beyond the Middle East, it was through the left. They changed their rhetoric, whereas they used to say, we are going to drive the Jews into the sea,
right,
which is they now said, no, the Jews have displaced the Palestinians. The Jews are responsible for the suffering of the Palestinians. They inverted. They who did not allow for a Jewish state said that the Jews were the ones who did not allow for a Palestinian state. And they totally inverted the situation from a right-wing attack to a left-wing attack. And this has had tremendous success. And it's only now as a left-wing movement that anti-Semitism is really working in the academies of the United States and at the United Nations and elsewhere. The right-wing anti-Jewish anti-Semitism, you know, is not popular. You know, the newsreels of what happened under Hitler are just too well known for people to think that that's any kind of a political model. But left-wing anti-Semitism, that the Jews are Zionist, imperialist, colonialist, exploiters, this calls on a whole other aspect of anti-Jewish politics.
That aspect would seem unfamiliar to anyone looking at anti-Semitism through history. Was it just a new creation, as you mentioned, that came out of the Soviet Union?
Well, it was a new creation that adapted itself to a new condition. In other words, as long as the Jews were spread and dispersed among other people, the anti-Jewish politics took the form of being against the Jews in dispersion. Once the Jews began to talk about a homeland, return to their homeland, and certainly after the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, then it was just as easy to organize politics against the Jews in their homeland as it had been to organize politics against them out of their homeland. So, so this new form, as you call it, developed in relation to the changing condition of the Jewish people. But it calls on the same forces, and I go back to it. It has the same function. And so I think one of the things we have to train ourselves to do is to think of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism as not having to do with the Jews, but having to do with its perpetrators. Why do they use it? How do they use it? And particularly, what role does it play in their politics? Why is it so important to them? Why must they organize their politics against the Jews?
Because it creates an additional, or because it creates a motivating force, and because it works, as you noted before.
Yes, well, I tried to point out all the many functions that it has. It is a unifier, for one thing. It deflects attention from internal problems. It organizes violence against others. And I think that, you know, if you look at American politics today, you see that negative advertising is still extraordinarily effective. Many more people will tell you that, you know, negative advertising is the more powerful form of advertising, rather than saying, oh, what I'm doing, you know, promoting what you positively do. Well, I would say that anti-Semitism is the most effective form of negative advertising. You know, it is negative politics. It is blaming others, and it's a politics of grievance. You know, organizing grievance against another group. All those functions, and actually one can call on others, those functions make it a very important political instrument, a political tool.
Feminists, and it's an important, you probably can't say any one thing about feminists, but you have taken issue with the way so many feminists have opposed Israel, which is certainly the country in the Middle East where women have the greatest freedom and the highest participation level in every aspect of society. How do you see that having changed over the last 13 years since Jews in Power was originally published? And what do you think there's any future possibility of change in that direction?
Well, that's a very good question, a very painful one. I think that it is a feminist who coined the term intersectionality, which has become so popular. And what that means is that you organize the politics of grievance altogether. Intersectionality means that, look, all these grievance groups that we have, African Americans who have a grievance, Latinos who have a certain kind of grievance, the gay and lesbian movement, which feels that it is threatened in its own way, and women who have become really the dominant politics of grievance in the United States in particular, all these groups now organize on campuses. And again, you can see that the one thing that they have organized around is the Palestinian cause. Now, when you take these things, these threads, and you pull them apart, you can scratch your head and you can say, well, wait a minute, this is preposterous. What has one thing got to do with the other? Especially since, as you say, if you are a feminist, shouldn't you be concerned about the treatment of women in the Arab world, not in Israel? And again, if you are concerned about slavery or anything of that kind, you should be looking...
Human trafficking, all of the things that are taking place that aren't particularly taking place in Israel.
In Israel, exactly. And so we come at it and we say, but, and we try to provide the positive evidence. And we think that positive arguments are going to sway these people. But they don't because, as I say, they want this coordinated politics of grievance. This grievance coalition, you could call it, on campuses is really strong, and they have decided that the Palestinian cause is the only one that they can actually pursue. There are reasons for that, but the Palestinians, I mean, the Arab world in general, has been particularly successful in pushing that narrative, in pushing that idea of the Jewish colonizer and the Jewish orientalist, if you will.
Following Edward Said's
exactly,
definition of the
term. Yes. Edward Said's argument now really focused on the Palestinians in particular. So as preposterous as it is, it doesn't have anything to do with what we would call reality. And if you wanted to just, you know, sit somebody down, and if logic could actually persuade anyone, yeah, you could show that this is all ridiculous. But it doesn't have to do with political logic. It has to do with a different form of political logic, and that is the logic of how politics can be used for certain causes.
One final question. I feel we've gone a long time, but we're almost out of time. Often we say that Israel's been really bad at Hasbara, has done a terrible job of public relations, and that's the principal reason that it gets so much bad press in the West. And why do you think that's really what the problem has been?
Thank you for the question. I don't think that's where the problem has been. You see, I think that Israelis have had to fight the war on the ground for 70-odd years now, and it's not any easier than it was. It's become in some ways more complicated. That's what they do. They have to fight the war in order just to preserve the country. The physical preservation of the country is all important. I think it's we in America who have fallen down on the job, not just Jews, but Americans too. I think that just as they fight the battle, the real war, we have to fight the war of words. And have we done a good job of it? I don't think so. And I think it's because liberals don't understand that they have to, if they're going to really uphold liberal values, the highest liberal value is the right of the Jewish people to exist in its homeland. On a political, you know, on an international level, that has always been one of the, you know, fundamental issues around which Christianity has turned, around which Islam has turned. And you can't shove it away. So if there is a question of Hasbara, if there's a question of having to explain and doing a better job of it, I think that that is really our obligation, not Israel's.
I want to thank Professor Ruth Weiss for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her book, Jews in Power, has just been reissued in paperback. Strongly recommend it to anybody who wants to understand what's going on, not only with the Jewish relationship, the politics throughout history, but in the Middle East right now. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate this.
Where can people go to find out more about you and more about the book?
Well, the book is available from Amazon, and it's published by Penguin Random House. I hope people do read it and buy it and read it. And discuss it, actually. I think it's a good book for discussion. I'm now a fellow at the Tikva Fund. I write for Mosaic, which is the web magazine of Tikva. I write at the Jewish Review of Books, which is, again, the magazine that is put out by the Tikva Fund. And I think its website is probably one of the things that I would recommend.
Absolutely. Bye-bye now. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol.
The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Jacqueline Jules, author of the wonderful new Jewish children's book, The Generous Fish. Our playout this morning comes from Yiddish-American singer Basheva singing Leonard Cohen's Dance Me to the End of Love. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov and a week we pray of peace.
Dance me to your beauty with a burning violin.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.